Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 2nd of December. In her piece in ProPublica, our guest this hour cites these statistics. In 2012, 90 people were killed in shootings like the ones in Newtown and Aurora and here in Oak Creek, Wisconsin. That same year, nearly 6,000 black men were murdered with guns. She wrote a piece titled How the Gun Control Debate Ignores Black Lives. By failing to talk about the majority of gun murder victims, black men, politicians and advocates are missing the chance to save lives. And she outlines programs in the country, particularly a ceasefire program that seems to be particularly effective in lessening gun violence. Joining us this hour to talk about all of this is Lois Beckett. Lois is a reporter at ProPublica. She covers the intersection of data, technology, and politics, and has a current focus on gun violence and gun policy. Her Essent story on PTSD, Black America's Invisible Crisis, won a 2015 Deadline Award for Public Service and a National Association of Black Journalists Salute to Excellence Award in Investigative Journalism. We're going to be welcoming phone calls for Lois during the course of this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and you can find us on Twitter as well, and that's at K Dunn Show. Hi, Lois. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Why don't we start with the meeting in January of 2013, a month after Newtown, more than a dozen religious leaders in Washington to talk about what we should do to address gun violence.
So at that meeting with Vice President Biden, faith leaders came together to talk about all the different things that they wanted to see to tackle the epidemic of gun violence in America. And one of the people in that room was Pastor Michael McBride, a very young minister from Berkeley who did a lot of work with young people dying in Oakland. Pastor McBride really supported universal background checks. He supported an assault weapons ban. He wanted to see tougher gun laws in America. But he had also done a lot of research about what works to save the lives of black men in particular. And he found that, background checks might be very helpful for that, but also changing the culture and changing the strategies of local police departments had a really strong track record of Justice Department research showing that it could dramatically reduce the number of shootings and homicides over the short term. And so his ask to the vice president was, let's get stricter gun laws, but let's also invest money in helping police departments be smarter about how they work to prevent the shootings of black men.
Mm-hmm.
And he found the reaction was just, urban violence is very important, he kept hearing again and again, but that's not what the national will is about. The national will at this moment is to address mass shootings.
Right. And it's striking when you read, though, I could read that sentence over and over, as you cite early on, and I said at the top of the show, 90 people killed in shootings, like the horrible shootings in Newtown, Aurora, Oak Creek as well, but 6,000 black men murdered with guns? That is a huge number of human beings.
It's just incredible, and I think a lot of us sort of know in general that maybe urban violence doesn't get as much attention as mass shootings get, but when you actually look at the number of people dying, half of all gun homicide victims in America every day, every year, are black men, and yet this is a group of people we just don't talk about, and this is a group of people who are not driving the political reaction to gun violence in America.
Mm-hmm. And why is that? Are there people who have their own agendas? The Brady group looking at this issue, there are a lot of different groups looking at the issue of gun violence, but they're going a different direction.
Well, I think it's important to know that the gun control movement, the Brady campaign, Bloomberg's Every Time for Gun Safety, these are people who really support stricter gun laws and who are really focused on also in gun culture. And that doesn't mean that they don't care about urban gun violence. In fact, I've talked to them. They all care a lot about it. And they really believe that fighting for stronger background checks is a thing that would help save the lives of black men. For the research we have, yes, it seems that likely that background checks would be helpful, but certainly wouldn't make the problem go away completely. And we actually just don't know how many lives universal background checks would save. But the national conversation on this revolves only around gun laws when there's a lot of evidence that actually taking multiple approaches might work best to save the most lives.
Mm-hmm. And from the statistics that you cite in your article, we do have a sense of how many lives can be saved if people in various cities had strong ceasefire programs. Let's talk about that program.
So ceasefire was created in Boston in 1996 and got very dramatic results when police officers and black ministers and local outreach workers got together and to identify the young men most likely to shoot and be shot, and then use basically every recourse they had to try to convince those men to stop the violence, to put their guns down. They saw a 63% decrease in monthly youth homicides, just really dramatic. So other cities have replicated that. Not everyone, no one has gotten a 63% decrease. But regularly you see 20, 30% decreases in homicides or in shootings, especially if you're looking particularly at the young men in these violent networks that are driving most of the violence, you can really make a big difference in how many lives are being lost every year. That's mostly been studied in the short term. It's not clear how well these programs work over the long term, but it's pretty reliable. If you implement one of these programs very carefully and very rigorously, you're going to save some lives.
And those violent networks you cite in places like Oakland and other cities, I'm sure, as well, we tend to think they're very large, but I think it was in Oakland that it was narrowed down to 50 to 100 young African-American men who are most likely to be doing the shooting.
So in Oakland, it was about 1,000 or 1,200 young men who are members of these violent networks. And at any one time, because a lot of the shootings are driven by personal disputes and retaliations, this isn't about drug business. This is really much more smaller and more personal than that, that you could isolate 50 to 100 people who are most likely to be driving the violence. And if you're talking about how to make a police department more effective, if you can go from looking at hundreds of thousands of people to 1,000 people to looking at 100 people and target your resources accordingly, makes a big difference in what you can do.
And how are those resources targeted? They get together in a room with who and what's said?
What happens is the first step is really the data, and the first step is saying who is driving the violence and who are the friends and associates of these people who are most at risk. What's really interesting here is that, if you think about gun violence as a disease or a public health problem, is that your associations, your social networks can drive your risk. And so the first step is to bring together a lot of different people from different law enforcement agencies and say who was killed in the last year, who was shot in the last year, and what do we know about the people who are connected to those people and who are likely to be at risk this year, this month, this week. And then once you do that, you can look at the different networks of violent groups and say, okay, these two groups or these four groups are really feuding a lot. They've been shooting a lot. They are driving most of the risk. Let's call them in and say, this has to stop now. We're putting a premium on stopping the violence. Whatever other illegal activity you're doing will get a normal response for us, but any shooting is going to get a very special, very targeted response. And in a lot of cities, they're going to hold the whole group accountable for any shooting. The idea being, because this violence is driven by social interaction and social pressure, that you also want to use this group social pressure to convince people that they should not shoot.
Mm-hmm. And then you talk about this 2012 review finding 7 or 8 cities who rigorously implemented ceasefire had similar reductions in violence. So the question is, why wouldn't you have this program implemented and funded all over the country?
That's a great question, and I think that's the one that lots of advocates have. Certainly, ceasefire is something that many police chiefs know about. It's very well known within the law enforcement community, but it is a very resource-intensive operation. It's not that it's expensive, but in order to do it, you have to have the U.S. attorney at the table, you have to have the local prosecutor, you have to have the police department, you have to have the mayor on board, you have to have a lot of different city agencies, which often don't get along, all on the same page and all agreeing to work together. And that turns out to be very hard. And police chiefs change frequently, mayors change frequently, and there's a lot of pressure to create the new plan or the new initiative. And so something that even in cities that saw tremendous success, even in Boston, with Boston, who had created Boston Ceasefire, these initiatives have broken down when the key players have moved on, when the mayor has switched. And so what you see is sort of an ADD in which departments will put a lot of effort into launching these strategies, and then whether they work or not, they'll just completely fall apart.
Mm-hmm. They may not have been centered on urban violence after Newtown and Aurora and Oak Creek, but you do write that in the 2014 budget, President Obama asked for more money for local grant programs to combat urban gun violence, but he didn't get what he wanted, not by a long shot.
Yeah, what's so interesting here is that President Obama has not lifted up these strategies, ceasefire in particular, or others, as part of his rhetoric about addressing gun violence in America. He's been much more focused on gun laws and, frankly, much more focused on blaming the NRA for standing in the way of passing stricter gun laws. But if you actually look at the money he's asking for, he's pushing to fund these programs better, and he's pushing to help the Justice Department give more money to incentivize police departments to try this more intensive thing, and frankly, just to bring all of those different players who need to play nice with each other, that money can bring them to the table. And the amounts of money we were asking for here from the Justice Department are often not very much. Obama has requested something like $79 million, $60 million, and Congress has given half that. If you look at, as I did, a series of different grants that support this kind of smarter policing, they're getting in the range of $31 or $30.5 million a year, and that just doesn't break down to very many cities being helped with this.
Let's talk about Baltimore for a moment. You talk about Baltimore having its 300th homicide this year, the most since 1999. Do they have a ceasefire program or something similar?
Yes, Baltimore has been trying over the past couple of years, relaunching a ceasefire effort in two of the districts, and it has obviously struggled. Trying to understand more about why that struggled is difficult. Daniel Webster, one of the researchers who is evaluating the effort, said that the rollout last year in the Western District, he was skeptical about whether they were really following the model. This year in another district, he said it looks a little bit more promising. But when we're talking about local programs, unlike gun laws, you pass a gun law, it's done, it's set, and it's in place going forward. But with a local program, as we've seen in Baltimore, the head of the program resigned, the Baltimore Sun reported earlier this year, conflict over whether there were enough resources involved. There's been tremendous tension between different city bureaucracies about sharing real-time data about homicides, which is a crucial part of any process in identifying who's most likely to be shot, but also with the tension in Baltimore between the police and prosecutors, some real questions there about whether that data sharing is possible. So it's often really hard to disentangle, you know, whether these why these strategies aren't working if they're in place, and who exactly is to blame for that.
Indianapolis homicide set to increase for third straight year. They applied for a grant to help implement ceasefire. But just four, you say, of more than roughly 60 cities that apply receive funding. Indianapolis did not.
Yeah, there's just a lot of different factors in play here, and Indianapolis, really interesting that they got a lot of consensus that they wanted to sort of restart the ceasefire model. Indianapolis had used this in 1999, seen a lot of success, one of those cities on paper that really succeeded with this, and then throughout the 2000s let it crumble. And a lot of local activists were pushing in 2012 to restart this, to pay some money to outside consultants to come in and help them implement ceasefire in a sort of more updated way, taken some of the lessons that cities have learned over the past few years as they've implemented this. And, you know, they didn't get the federal grant, as most cities who applied for it didn't. An advocate there who had been pushing for ceasefire said the city county council wasn't willing to pay for it either. And so what you see in Indianapolis, and in fact in a lot of cities that are struggling with this, is that, you know, a lot of the efforts that you that have evidence behind them are being implemented sort of halfway. They're being half-funded. They're sort of struggling to stay afloat. And, you know, that's something you see just across the country, is there's tremendous work going on the ground, especially among community advocates, to prevent violence, to do all kinds of different efforts. And they're just, none of them are being funded to scale.
And it's interesting because those are the people who understand what's going on, like Pastor McBride, the work that he's been doing. And he was also a victim of a violent action by police in California. These people really understand who the young people are who are being victims of violence or are committing acts of violence, and yet they don't seem to be listened to. You do talk about, and I'm wondering the extent of this program, the President's My Brother's Keeper program. Does that address, how extensive is that, and does that address, Lois, the issue of gun violence?
So My Brother's Keeper is designed and was launched last year just to lift up the issue of young men and boys of color and helping them succeed in many ways. And one of the six different issue areas that they named as things that needed attention was violence. But, you know, this is an initiative that President Obama is doing largely with outside support, philanthropic donors pledging, I'm going to give this amount to mentoring, I'm going to give this amount to help young men and boys of color do better in the education system, take more advanced placement classes. And, you know, theoretically, this could have been a moment for the president or other folks to talk about, you know, what are the strategies that are seeing the most success at the local level? You know, what are the cities who are part of My Brother's Keeper who are really getting this right and seeing results? And so far, that kind of lifting up of some strategies hasn't been part of the program. You know, it's been more of a broad, let's encourage cities to address this in whichever and whatever way they want to do, and let's support some more politically safe things like mentoring or education, which nobody disagrees with, versus some policing and community programs, which have gotten very strong results, but are complicated and politically difficult.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, and I think there's some validity to this, that people who are in segregated communities, very poor communities, as you say, don't have political clout, they don't have economic power, they don't vote. And yet, in a city's own self-interest, even if you don't care about what you should, everybody who lives in your city, it does give an impression, and I know this is true in the Milwaukee area, which is too bad that this happens, but people who move out and still depend on the city for their economic livelihood are suddenly afraid to come in the city because they think violence is omnipresent, and it really puts a kind of a bad mark on cities, so that the violence which may be contained, and it's horrible that people are dying, but if you don't care about black lives, don't you care about your city?
I think that's a really interesting and complicated problem, and one thing that I think is certainly true, having reported this both at the local level and the national level, is that when you're talking about cities, mayors, police chiefs, like, these are all people who really care and see a very clear interest in reducing gun violence in their cities. You know, there's nobody that I have found in reporting in many cities who just isn't trying to tackle this. The issue at the local level is, are you doing the things that are the most effective? You know, are you following the best practices or are you not? Are you letting local politics undermine the stuff that might be working better? So it's not a question of, do cities care? It's a question of, are they doing the right things? And, you know, everybody's trying, but who's been having the most success? And, you know, why aren't more people doing the things that seem to be working? What you really don't get, the sort of don't care, not an issue, is in Washington, in Congress, these issues just don't make it onto the agenda. And the funding and the attention and sort of the standing up and fighting, you know, there just isn't a clear champion for these young men who are dying in Washington, people standing up for them and saying, we must address this. This is an atrocity. This cannot continue, in a way that you do see from police chiefs and from mayors who are really have been trying to bring this nationally. I spoke last year to Mitch Landrieu in New Orleans, who has used the ceasefire model with some success there. And he said he has been trying for several years to bring the issue of young black men dying to the national stage to get more attention for it. And he said it just does not seem to resonate with the national conscience.
Isn't that something? We welcome phone calls, and we'll take them in a moment. Lois Beckett is our guest this hour. She is a reporter at ProPublica and has been concentrating lately on gun violence and gun policy. She wrote a very interesting piece recently published, How the Gun Control Debate Ignores Black Lives, by failing to talk about the majority of gun murder victims, black men, and it is a huge majority. Politicians and advocates are missing the chance to save lives. We have a couple lines ringing. We'll go to you in a moment and welcome you to join our conversation. The number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page, where we'd like to read your messages, is the Kathleen Dunn Show. And we're on Twitter as well, at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls for Lois. Cheryl in Oak Creek is first. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi there.
Hi.
I guess my comment and question would be concerning urban gun violence. It just seems that we don't ever start with the conversation where the core problem is, and that would be the lack of family unit. We're always looking for a Band-Aid or a solution after the fact, but we start with young women bringing children into the world when they're not emotionally or financially prepared. So these children often don't have a family in the home. They don't have a good role model or family support. And they're being born and raised in neighborhoods with crime and violence. And I believe it just is, it becomes a vicious cycle. And until we can address that, children just being born into poverty, without all the supports they need, we really aren't going to turn this around. And I'll take my comment off the air.
Thanks, Cheryl. Thanks for your call. Lois.
Cheryl, that's such an interesting comment, and certainly many, many people share your views and think that this, especially thinking about black families, is really important when thinking about gun violence. But I think I want to caution that the data doesn't quite line up with a simple interpretation of looking at sort of single-parent families. Take Oakland, for instance. If you look at Oakland back in the 1990s, about 30% of Oakland children were growing up in single-parent families. Look at Oakland today, again, roughly a third of Oakland people are living underneath the poverty line. So you might expect Oakland to be a terrifically violent place if single-parent families and poverty were enough just to make people violent. But if you actually look at the number of young men who are involved in driving Oakland's violence, that 1,000 young men, that's 0.3% of everyone. So, you know, even if all of those young men who are driving the violence came from single-family homes, came from poverty, which we don't know if they are or not, it's just like the majority of single-parent families are not producing people who are violent. Like, they're just not. And so there's been a lot of tendency to sort of blame the black family for violence in America that ignores the fact that the actual problem of violence is quite concentrated. It's a very small number of people. And if you look at the success of these programs, that it is not possible to make violence go away with a ceasefire or a strategy like that. But you can cut it by as much as 20 or 30% just by policing differently, just by approaching the most violent young men differently. So I think it's really careful to distinguish between the idea, like, would it be helpful for us to think more about prevention or to tackle poverty? Those things are tremendously important. But to say that there's actually nothing we can do about this problem until we fix the problem of poverty in America or sort of radically change families in America is just not true. And that's why these programs are so interesting, because it shows that actually the problem of violence is a lot more responsive to small targeted changes, and that we can do a lot with even without addressing the large structural problem.
Let me go back to something you said earlier and read what you wrote in your piece, because I don't know how you tackle this, and I'm not sure why this is so prevalent. Violence, you write, often starts a fight over a girlfriend, a couple of words, a dispute over a dice game. These are men who do not trust the police to keep them safe, so they take matters into their own hands. Men involved in these conflicts may want a safer life, but it's hard for them to put their guns down. I think that says a whole lot.
Yeah, I think, you know, as a reporter, you're always entering into covering a new area, coming from a place of, like, a general reader or a general listener, when you just know sort of the average other people that other people do. And I remember when I first started covering this, it seemed so impossible for me to understand, you know, why anyone would pick up a gun and kill another person.
Right.
But I think the more time you spend with the data and the more time you spend to talking to young men and men who are dealing with these problems, who are, like, folks like you and me, and just in extremely desperate situations for the most part, the more you understand that we're not talking about people who are shooting each other wantonly for no reason, that we're talking about men who are facing a higher risk of having someone else shoot them, mm-hmm. are legitimately afraid for their lives in a way that is not, that is borne out by the data, that there actually are a tremendously greater risk of being shot than anyone else in America. And so I think that our approach to how do we deal and solve this problem has to start with that reality.
Right. Absolutely. Let's go to Matt in Viroqua next. Hi, Matt.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
While the problem of inner-city violence is very troubling, I think it's important to put perspective on the situation. According to the FBI Uniform Crime Report, gun violence is as low as it has been in this country in the last 40 years. So that's just kind of a point of hope, I suppose you could say. And not only is violence limited very strictly to inner cities, it's almost a block by block phenomena. And so I think that solutions to it need to take that into consideration as well. I'll take my answer off here.
Thanks, Matt.
Matt, great point. It's true that violence has gone down tremendously since 1993, but one thing that's interesting when you're looking at the actual crime trends is that we saw this tremendous drop in gun murders from 1993 to about 2000, and then it stopped. And in fact, for the past decade or more, we've looked at about the same number of homicides every year, 10,000, 11,000, 12,000, going up and down a little bit, but really not declining dramatically since 2001. And over that time, about half of those gun homicides have been black men. So are things better now than they were in the 90s? Absolutely. We are much, much safer than we used to be. But still, this is a stubborn problem, and it's not just continuing to drop.
But as you say, we don't really know why the homicides went down so substantially, do we? Why can't we figure that out?
So there's a lot of theories, and there's a good sense that we know some of the things that contributed. Certainly the dramatic jump in gun violence in the late 80s and 90s was driven by the crack epidemic, so the sort of unwinding of the crack epidemic is part of it coming down. Mm. Mass incarceration has played some role in that dramatic crime drop, but researchers say it was not the majority of the responsibility for the drop, and also mass incarceration has had tremendous costs on families, on communities. So we might have gotten a reduction in violence from that, but we're paying the cost in other ways. And there's lots of other theories, some involving abortion, some involving lead, that may have played some role in the drop in violence. But we don't know for sure sort of what all of that drop came from.
Oscar in Milwaukee, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I associate myself with plenty of gun fanatics. Most of them, they have the carry conceal permit. Recently this year, I first started to go to plenty of gun shows, and most of the people who go to gun shows, they go through rigorous background checks. And most of these people are they are very knowledgeable of their weapons, and I think that it's more of a hobby for weapon owners to discuss accessories, weapons, and such as that class. Now regarding with the violence, if we were to implement a bigger, more rigorous background checks, a question may come to arise that what if somebody has never had any priors going through our background checks, but yet you see shootings. As of this recently that happened in Colorado, unfortunately, you see shootings such as this, such as these. And the problem is that what happens when nobody has any priors and crimes like this happen, what can be done to solve this? And I was just saying, I live in Milwaukee, and people don't want to call the police, because if they call the police, they show up, and then they start asking questions like, okay, so what is your name and what is your background, blah, blah, blah. And then they start finding, oh, well, you owe tickets. And if people, if they feel like they're in danger, and then the attention gets directed towards them more than the actual danger they face with other people, that's why minorities in general don't want to call the police regarding that certain issue, because they're the one who ends up getting victimized instead of getting help.
Lois.
Oscar, those are two really great points. I really appreciate them, you bringing them both up. First, yeah, I think it's a really important always when discussing gun violence and gun laws to remember that most gun owners are totally responsible. Everyone talks after mass shootings about how many guns, an estimated 300 million guns in America, and most of those are not being used in a way that harms anybody. They're being used by people who want them for self-defense, who want them for a hobby, but they're most of the time just not a problem. And in our conversation, which is driven by these terrible tragedies and driven by people who have very polarized, very pro and very anti-gun views, that often gets ignored or glossed over. And I think gun owners are often frustrated by the lack of knowledge by the general public about firearms or about trends in firearm violence. But their second point is, I think, actually even just tremendously important, which is a lot of times when we talk about gun violence in America, as an earlier caller noted, we talk about family or we talk about poverty, and we don't talk about the police and the relationship between the trust that you as an individual or as a neighborhood have that police are going to be able to help you and solve your problems and keep you safe. And the levels of violence in a community or the number of people who are going to take matters into their own hands and not trust the criminal justice system to keep them safe, but instead use violence. And what was so striking in talking to many of the pastors that I interviewed for my story who are pushing for these ceasefire programs is that they're so frustrated by this constant zero-sum game or this constant toggling back and forth between you can either care about quote-unquote black-on-black crime or you can care about police violence. And for them, these are two sides of the same coin, the what it really means to make our neighborhoods in America, all of our neighborhoods in America, safer, includes, you know, helping us reduce violence by increasing neighborhoods' trust in police. That these are things that go together.
I want to go back to that room where these identified, and there aren't that many of them, those who shoot and are most likely to get shot, are meeting with this variety of people, the police and social service agencies, et cetera. What do they learn? I mean, do they learn to not shoot? To how do they find themselves in safer situations? How does it all translate into less violence with these people who are identified?
So one of the things that's most important here is that when we think about the criminal justice system, we often think about laws and we think about threats and police chiefs and legislators call for greater penalties, more time for gun crimes, and sort of skips over the step, which is, you know, people in order to respond to the threats or incentives of the criminal justice system like need to actually understand them pretty well. And in talking especially to police officers in Oakland, which have really embraced the ceasefire strategy, they said that what was so novel and amazing to them about this idea was the idea that before you actually arrested someone or before you started enforcing the law, that you would just meet with someone and have a very frank conversation and say, here's what you're doing. Here are the risks that you are facing. I want to make sure you really understand, you know, what are the penalties here? What are the risks here? And that you are an enforcement priority for us. And talking to a lieutenant there in the Oakland Police Department, he said, this is just clearly a win for us. Even if we call in 30 young men to this room and we say we think you're among the most likely to shoot or be shot, you are going to be an enforcement priority for us. We think you are valuable members of this community. We want you to change your lives. We have all of here these social services providers that we want to have available to you. We will sometimes move you to the front of the line to get services, whether that's drug counseling, whether that's housing. We are taking very seriously our promise that we want to help you. And on the other hand, we have prosecutors, we have the U.S. attorney, we have the police, who if you continue shooting, you'll be at the top of our priority list. You can't think that you're going to continue to shoot someone and that you are going to get the normal criminal justice right. system response, which is maybe you'll get a response, maybe you won't, maybe you'll be a priority, maybe you won't, that you are going to be the top priority for everyone in this room. Mm-hmm. And just and it turns out that just making sure that people really understand their options and know that it's no longer sort of a random system, that know that they're truly a priority for the top law enforcement agencies in a city, that is very powerful.
Mm-hmm. And what about the element of help? You talk about liberals who talk about life circumstances and social services stepping in. It would seem to me as though that may be a key component here, is to have some other place to go, to have a job of some kind, to have an income, to have a sense of purpose.
Yeah, I think that what makes these strategies very complicated is that they realize that to really change your behavior, and that's how a lot of these strategies approach this, is not just thinking about this in moral terms, but thinking about the likelihood of shooting someone else as a habit that people get into and that they need to break. And what does it take to break that habit? And the experience of these programs shows that it helps to have some of those support, whether that's a job, whether that's legal counseling, a whole range of things, whether that's housing. A lot of people who are very violent don't even have a place to live. They're constantly sort of sleeping on friends' couches, trying to find a place. But at the same time, knowing that those enforcement threats are there as well. And the thing to realize is that we're talking about human beings, and each of them are motivated and involved in violence for different reasons. And these programs don't choose a theory. It's not like that social services are the answer, that enforcement is the answer. It's that we know whose behavior is driving the violence, and we want to give them whatever opportunities and whatever pressure we as a community can give in order to change that.
Yeah. Oscar, thanks for your call. Travis in Madison, hi.
Hi there. I just got a question regarding the, you know, you're talking about stricter gun laws and also in the same topic with, you know, inner city crime and and stuff like that. I was just wondering how many of those guns that they come across are like legally registered guns. Does that question make sense?
Yeah, it totally makes sense.
So, like, are these the kind of people that are going out and buying a legal gun and then going and shooting somebody, or?
So it really varies. I don't have data for Milwaukee specifically. If you look at places that have done surveys to try to find out where crime guns come from, a lot of it is purchased from a friend or gotten from a friend, gotten sort of through the illicit market. And it's really hard to, because our federal gun laws are relatively lax, it's really hard to know where these guns come from. We don't actually have a lot of information federally or locally. Some guns come through theft. Some guns do come through legal purchases. A lot come through straw purchasing, which is someone who has a record that would bar them from buying a gun, gets a girlfriend or another friend to who has a clean record to buy it for them. So we have surveys and a little bits of data here and there that suggest that straw purchasing is a real problem and sort of illicit gun markets are a real problem. But it's hard to get really good national data on this. And the rationale for something like a universal federal background check law is just to try to be a little bit stricter and close some of these loopholes in terms of feeding this illicit market where someone will purchase a gun legally and it will end up in the hands of someone who's not allowed to purchase a gun.
Thanks, Travis, for the call. Here's an email. The elephant in the room here is drugs. So many violent criminal acts are related to the trade and sale of drugs. With that in mind, do policymakers need to take a closer look at drug policy, Lois?
That's a really interesting question, and certainly in the bigger picture, you know, what has the relationship been between the war on drugs and gun violence? Talking to Daniel Webster at Johns Hopkins University, he is a strong proponent of rethinking how we approach drugs as a way to deal with violence, as a way to deal with some of those root issues. At the same time, it's also important to realize if you're talking about Milwaukee, for instance, as the police chief Flynn has said often, or places like Oakland or Kansas City, a lot of the violence we're talking about is being carried out by people who may have sold some drugs or be involved in the drug trade, but it's not business-related for the most part. That varies a bit from city to city. But in Oakland, for instance, only a small handful of the homicides that the experts analyzed were driven by turf wars or by drug disputes, and a lot of it was personal issues or longstanding feuds between groups. So that's one of the things that's the most sad about the violence that we see today, is that it's not about drug business, that it's about people dealing with their everyday disputes through lethal violence.
Right. John in La Crosse, hi.
Thank you. I'm just very interested in this subject, and I thank you for having this show. I keep thinking that this is a cultural issue, that somehow these groups of people who are prone to violence and gun use are somehow believe that's, you know, the way they should act. And I would like you, if you would, please, to describe the cultural values of this group. They do apparently value being macho, tough guys. I mean, I see it in the movies. I see it everywhere, in the music. And how much does that contribute? And isn't that really the problem? It's a cultural problem. It's not a problem of sending the police to threaten them, basically. It's a problem of changing this culture. In La Crosse, we recently had two young people, 17 and 18, shoot each other. One killed the other, standing in front of him, pumped 9 bullets into him. It's just extremely tragic. They thought they were tough guys, and they now are as a monument with flowers and mementos at the place of the killing, which I think does nothing but add. I think we need our leadership to say these people are despicable. They're not what young people should aspire to be. Please comment.
So that question of culture and of gun violence being driven by culture, and especially black culture is how people often phrase it, is a very troubling one. And certainly for decades, policymakers and politicians have been railing against the culture of violence, against rap music, against sort of the idea of being a tough guy. And, you know, all of those decades of railing against culture has not produced any results in terms of, you know, since 2000, we're seeing the same number of homicides every year, the same number of young men dying. And so in thinking about what has actually shown an effect in reducing violence, it's certainly important to understand that just wanting to be a tough guy is not the only factor in play here, that there are economic factors, factors of poverty that are involved. But the most important factor is that when you're talking about these young men and why they might want to act or be tough guys, is that these are people who actually do face what might be 100 times greater risk of being murdered than other people in America. So I think it's very important that culture is a very contentious and bitter issue, and what role it might play or might not play is something that people can continue to debate. But if you're trying to understand why a young man might aggressively shoot someone else, pick up a gun, carry a gun, why you might, in fact, do a similar thing, you have to think, am I someone who is at risk of dying and doesn't trust the police to protect me? How would I face that? And I think that really changes your perspective on what is the most important thing to do to tackle this problem.
Yeah, that's interesting because it narrows it to what exactly is going on. You can look at American culture and how much domestic violence we have in this country, how much general violence we have. You could say that America has a culture of violence too, couldn't you? But it's interesting to pinpoint what you just said. That's a whole different way of looking at it.
And lots of kids like rap music, kids of all races, kids across the United States, and they are fine, and they are not hurting anybody, and they're just listening to music, and like every teenager in America pretty much wants to be a tough guy, and only a very small number of them are a tremendous risk of actually killing somebody or being killed, and so we need to focus in on the people who are really driving the problem.
Yeah, which is, you know, you can't ignore that some rap music, though, is very anti-woman. But that's another subject.
A separate question, right?
Exactly.
Whether you like it or whether you don't, right?
Exactly.
Like it's not going to be the lane that's going to drive you to actually saving people's lives.
Right. More phone calls in just a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And you can also reach us via email, which is talk@WPR.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter as well, @KDunnShow. Lois Beckett is our guest. She's a reporter at ProPublica, and we're talking about a recent piece that she has written, which is very, very extensive, and it looks at, well, the title of it says what it's about, how the gun control debate ignores black lives. By failing to talk about the majority of gun murder victims, black men, politicians, and advocates are missing the chance to save lives. More from you in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, next phone call is Margie in Milwaukee. Hi, Margie.
Hi. Love the show and really interested in what you're doing with inner city groups to talk to the at-risk people. I think that's fabulous. What I'm always mystified is that the gun owners that have this strong desire to protect their gun rights, I don't understand why they're not at the table, at the forefront, to help craft legislation that they could be satisfied with. And the take on no legislation at all is it's really living in denial, and it's perpetuating a lot of this. When I canvassed for Obama in 08, I talked to a lot of NRA people out in some of the very conservative areas I was canvassing in, and I challenged them. I said, why? You know, they were so concerned of Obama taking their guns away, and I said, well, why? For one thing, it's 15 and it hasn't happened. And why aren't you at the table leading the discussion with how we can protect your gun rights at the same time as protecting the sick people that don't need to have it? And that piggybacks on the last caller that I was very I was irritated with that take about the gun culture in the inner city, because I think there's a gun culture with the good old boys that have their guns for sport and hobby and things like that, and that they don't see the danger in guns for other reasons. So there's all kinds of cultures that people are involved in, and you can't blame the people.
Lois.
So really interesting and complicated question, and certainly if you look at surveys and polls of gun owners, you'll see a lot of support for things like universal background checks, that you also have groups like the National Rifle Association or Gun Owners of America that take a harder line and really oppose even things that many gun owners in polls say that they support. I think it's really important to recognize a couple of things. One, a lot of the standard gun control debate in America, a lot of the rhetoric is very anti-gun. So if you're someone who is a responsible gun owner who likes your guns and knows that your guns aren't causing any problems, and see this tremendously anti-gun rhetoric, you know, for some people that can be a real turnoff. One of the things in my article that I wrote about was that the assault weapon ban is something that continues to be a real passionate cause for people, particularly on the left, who don't see any reason that anyone needs to have a military-style rifle. But this is something that, there was a federal assault weapons ban in place for a decade, and while there was some evidence that banning high-capacity magazines that allow you to fire lots of rounds of ammunition in a short time might have an impact in saving some lives, that sort of banning guns because of the way they looked or because of their military-style features, there just isn't a lot of evidence that that would have a tremendous impact on gun homicide in America, because ordinary handguns are the things that are being used to kill the most Americans. So that there is a real tension in the entire debate between policies that are, frankly, culture war policies that pro-gun or anti-gun people support, and the sort of more boring technical policies that might have some impact on saving lives without going to either extreme. And so you'd have to ask gun owners sort of individually sort of where they fall on this. But one thing that I think is just really important to acknowledge is that not every gun control policy is something that's going to save a lot of lives. Some of them are just more culturally driven or driven by people's values, which is fine, but that does complicate the debate a lot.
You know, and as we speak, which is somewhat ironic, but it is I'm glad we're talking about where a lot of this violence is taking place, but as we are speaking today, the San Bernardino Fire Department, I'm just getting news on this, is responding to a 20-victim shooting incident at the Social Services Building. It's an active scene. Police are trying to secure the building. There may be up to 3 gunmen, she said, and the shooters were heavily armed and possibly wearing body armor. What can you say? Thanks, Margie, very much for your call. There'll be more on that, I'm sure, on the news from National Public Radio in a few minutes. Virginia in Janesville. Hi.
Hi. I was interested a few moments ago when I thought you actually got to the root of the problem in certain areas in Milwaukee, which is fear. Fear, living in really bad neighborhoods, being afraid. And you can't call the police. I've heard since the 1970s that when blacks call the police attack the people who call. And so that's really at one of the core problems, that security has to be improved for people, else you buy a gun and you shoot. But I called because there's a lot of data that you, I think, are ignoring that deals with child abuse as the root cause of violence. Child abuse, witnessing abuse, being in an abusive home, leads to violence later on. And Milwaukee is the center of sex trafficking of young girls, high incidences of rape and incest in the home, high incidents, almost a fetish for beating kids is the right thing to do because that makes them obedient. All these causes create violent adults.
Thank you so much, Virginia, for your expressing your concerns. Lois, we have about 30 seconds. I'm sorry.
Just want to say briefly, can't speak to Milwaukee, but it is true that we often focus on mental health because mental health drives the terrible mass shootings that we see and, as you point out, continue to see. But it's true that trauma and exposure to violence in the community by letting violence continue in our cities does actually seem to create a risk for violence in adults. And so when we think about mental health, we have to broaden it and think about trauma and exposure to violence as something that we're not treating as well as we should.
Yeah. Lois, thank you so much for your lengthy article and for being with us. You're giving us new information, which is very important. May it go to the front of the line.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Our pleasure. Lois Beckett, reporter at ProPublica, covers the intersection of data, technology, and politics. She's currently focused on gun violence and gun policy. Thanks very much to Chris Molina for producing this interesting and important hour, and to Chris Molina as well for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. We have news coming up from National Public Radio, and then we are going to talk to Tracy Stewart, who is the author of Do Unto Animals. All of that is coming up. Thanks for listening to this hour.